Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zimmer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by our Director of Religious Education, Karen Lapidus, and Mary Lou Holly, as serving as our worship associate this morning. I'd also like to extend a special welcome to our musical guests, Hannah Kobe, playing the piano this morning, and the Celtic Clan. Thank you so much for being with us. And finally, I'm delighted to share with you that we have concluded our annual stewardship campaign, and we have had perhaps the most successful campaign that we've had in years. And as a result of your wonderful effort, we will be able to be fair share to both the Ohio Meadville District and the Unitarian Universalist Association next year.
We light this chalice for the web of life which sustains us, for the sacred circle of life in which we have our being, for the earth, the sky above and below, for our Mother Earth, and for the mystery.
Come by the hills. I invite you now to become a mountain. To become a mountain, and we will be a mountain together. The call to worship this morning is going to be embodied. So I invite you to either stand or rise in your seat. Stretch those vertebrae that were sleeping and slumping and bring them. And on this mountain, we need the space all around us. We're all friends. We're going to be the mountain, and then we will be trees. So nice, let's take a nice deep breath together, mindful of our neighbors. So inhale up, stretching, and then bring that sky back down all around the mountain. Tall spine. One more. Inhale up. Exhale down. Now feel the strength, the majesty, and the timelessness of the mountain. Feel the strong base. And take one more breath yourself as the mountain. Lengthening strength. And on this mountain are many, many trees. And each of us is going to be a tree on that mountain. The tree will be the tree that you select. This could be an old tree, a young tree, a tree that's in the breeze, a tree that's absolutely stationary, a tree that's a home for birds. So feel yourself rooted. Bring your feet a little closer together. Bring the weight to one side of your body and keep your hips the same. This is a strong tree. And then slowly become however your branches are going to be. And this is spring, so you may want to be flowering. So up, that's it. Yes, and breathe. Inhale. Exhale. Very strong tree. And on a branch of this tree, you can look down and you see a crane in the distance. And all of a sudden you become this crane. Very, very gently flying. Now you spread your wings and you bring all the energy from the sun and the sky into our hearts. One more breath together. Inhale. Exhale back to mountain. We are all united. We are all of these things. Come, let us worship together.
I chose our story this morning about Rachel Carson to help us celebrate Earth Day and to remind us all that each and every one of us, as individuals or in groups, can do what we can to protect our beautiful Earth. Better living through chemistry. This was the motto of one of America's leading corporations in the 1950s. Chemicals could make better clothing. Chemicals could improve food. Chemicals could increase farm yields and improve our environment. Chemicals had helped us win the Second World War and would help us win future wars. Magazine and television ads and billboards shouted the message to the public, "Better living through chemistry was the American way." Marine biologist Rachel Carson disagreed, but she was used to going against the tide. Starting in the 1920s, it was rare for a woman to be a scientist, but she moved into her chosen field, working as an aquatic biologist with the United States government. Eventually, she became the editor-in-chief of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Carson wrote about the interconnected web, and the public loved her books. Rachel Carson took readers on a journey to the teeming abundance of the tidal pool, to the dark, mysterious ocean depths. Life was everywhere. Life was diverse. Life was a celebration. This sense of celebrating all forms of life made Rachel's writings different. People in the United States were used to being told that they were on top of the food chain and that other life on Earth existed to serve us. According to many religions, nature was created for man to meet his needs, food, shelter, and even a beautiful scene to contemplate. The world was made for us, and we are the most important creatures in it. Instead, Rachel's vision was biocentric or life-centered. Her books help people appreciate that we humans are just one part of nature's web of life. So imagine how Rachel felt when the United States dropped destructive atomic bombs on Japan in 1945. And imagine, too, how she felt when the United States government began dropping insecticide bombs on tiny enemies within our own borders, insects such as fire ants and mosquitoes. Before, humans had lived with the inconvenience of nature's insects. Now, the corporations that promised better living were manufacturing deadly chemicals to eradicate insects completely. Throughout the 1950s, airplanes sprayed these insecticides over America's bountiful farmlands, our pretty suburbs, and our crowded towns. The government supported it, and no one stopped to question it. Of course, the chemicals only eradicated the pests for a short while. Usually the insects came back even stronger than before. Worse, the chemicals killed much more than the insects. A friend of Rachel's lived next to a bird sanctuary. She wrote to Rachel and told her how after the government had sprayed DDT to kill mosquitoes, she found dozens of dying birds in her bird bath. Soon, Rachel began the fight of her life. She gathered data to show how chemistry was not giving us a better life, but harming life. Originally called Man Against Nature, the book she published as Silent Spring argued that spraying chemicals endangered life, including human life. And this is a copy of her book, which I'll be carrying through coffee hour if you'd like to take a peek. To convince her readers, Rachel included information from hundreds of scientific studies, explained in language the public could understand. She took care to avoid errors or exaggerating. She knew that she must be ready to back up every statement 100%, or the chemical companies could discredit her whole work. Rachel Carson knew she had one chance to change the course of history. Silent Spring leaped to the bestseller list. Yes, government and industry spokespeople tried to discredit Rachel for being sentimental or hysterical or for being a back-to-nature type. But the many, many people who saw her on television saw a clear-eyed woman with a detailed, objective truth to tell. On the other hand, the government officials responsible for the spraying had very few facts to prove DDT was safe, and the public sensed that Rachel was right. The debate about pesticide use sparked by Silent Spring gave momentum to the 1960s environmental movement. And in 1970, the government formed the Environmental Protection Agency. And in 1972, the government banned the use of DDT in the United States. And in that same year, Earth Day was proclaimed. Rachel Carson died shortly after the publication of her book, Silent Spring. One could say that it's a shame that she could not witness the growth of the environmental movement she did so much to create. But for Rachel, life was not about the individual. It was about diverse communities of beings that continuously recycle and renew life. In this sense, Rachel's courage, her vision of life, and her fierce argument against pesticides have become part of us. How will we live that vision in our lifetimes? What courage of ours will inform the next generation?
Today, we remember three of this community who have died in recent months. Robert Wood, whose artwork was remembered yesterday at the Kent Expo. Gordon Vars, whose life was honored last night at the Environmental Awards Dinner with an award for environmental activism. And Beth Schultes, whose life will be celebrated this afternoon in a memorial reception here in the sanctuary. And I invite you to join me in the spirit of prayer with a prayer that comes from the Ojibwe, a prayer for the earth. Grandfather, look at our brokenness. We know that in all creation, only the human family has strayed from the sacred way. We know that we are the ones who are divided, and we are the ones who must come back together to walk the sacred way. Grandfather, sacred one, teach us love, compassion, and honor, that we may heal the earth and heal each other. Amen. Rituals can have great power. In ritual time and space, we create the possibility for knowing, speaking, and connecting in ways that are a bit different from our ordinary lives. This morning, we'd like to share a ritual with you that's adapted from the creation of Joanna Macy and Molly Young Brown, two great environmental leaders of our own time. They created this ritual because they believe that all of us living in this time of planetary crisis are burdened with feelings of despair. We know that the Earth faces risks today that are unknown by previous generations. We know that the environmental problems we face are grave. And we also know that our time for making sufficient change is swiftly running out. In fact, many scientists say that it's already too late, that even if we were to stop burning fossil fuels at the rate that we burn them now, the atmosphere is already overloaded with carbon dioxide, more than it can handle. The result of the overload, they say, is that the consequences of global climate change are going to continue to wreak havoc around the globe. This knowledge is utterly terrifying, and yet each of us goes on with our days, our lives, our plans. Not knowing what else to do, many of us go on by simply stuffing our feelings about the peril we face. But any kind of emotional stuffing spells trouble. When we stuff our feelings, they don't go away. They just fester. Stuffed feelings lead us to distract ourselves with food or drink or whatever means we choose for escape. Stuffed feelings lead to ill health in body, mind, and spirit. Stuffed feelings are uncomfortable, so we find ways to distance, creating what can seem like apathy or indifference. When we do choose to pay attention, we're eager to know what we can do. What program or process or environmental effort has the most chance of averting the dangers we face? When the Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh was asked what he believes the most important thing we can do is to save our world, he replied, "What we most need to do is to hear within us the sounds of the earth crying." In this ritual, Macy and Brown are offering us a way to hear and to listen. They're offering us a way to express our feelings, to tell our particular truth. The goal is not to wallow in despair. but rather to create an opportunity for gently and genuinely acknowledging our feelings in order to free ourselves from their grasp and open ourselves to other possibilities. And so on this curved wooden bench, we have five objects. The stone. The stone is for fear. This is how our hearts feel when we're frightened. Hard, tight, heavy. Leaves, dry leaves, which are for sorrow. They represent our sorrow for all that is already dead, dying, and passing from this earth. A stick, which is for our anger. Anger is a normal and healthy emotion. It's natural to feel angry when profit is placed over the planet. The stick is not for hitting, but rather for holding. Holding onto when we're mad. It's strong enough not to break in the presence of our anger. And an empty bowl. An empty bowl which is for our hunger. The bowl represents our emptiness, our hunger, our yearning for what might yet be. And finally, hope. The glass globe is for hope. The hope is here too. In all of us, in all of life, the power of the earth to heal and to thrive. In the next few minutes, we invite you to speak your particular truth. In order to create enough time for everyone, we invite you to speak from your seats, limiting yourself to speaking just once. You tell us which ritual object you'd like us to lift up and speak the truth you have to tell. I'll repeat what you've said so that each person may hear it. And after each person speaks, we'll say together, "We hear you." This, of course, does not mean necessarily that we agree, but it does mean that we're listening to each person's truth with respect. Mary Lou and I will begin, and then anyone who wishes to will have an opportunity to speak. I speak of my sorrow. Sorrow, especially for the animals who spend their entire lives captured in factory farms with no opportunity to live dignified, decent lives.
Our, all of these environmental activities that are global continue and plant themselves here and globally, connecting.
We hear you. And now it's your turn to speak of your sorrow, your anger, your fear, your emptiness, or your hope. Hope for the restorative power of the earth. Will you join me? We hear you.
We hear you.
At the same time.
Strength to resist destruction.
We hear you.
Anger for the fate of the children. We hear you. Hope for the healing and restorative aspects of a plant-based diet. We hear you. Hunger for change. We hear you. Hope for compromise. We hear you. Fear of the dangers of fracking. We hear you. Anger at consumerism. We hear you. Hope that people will wake up and pay attention. We hear you. Sorrow that we often blame those who suffer. We hear you. Thank you to each of you who has chosen to share, and to all of you for listening with attention and respect. Truth-telling, Joanna Macy writes, is like oxygen. It enlivens us. Without it, we grow confused and numb. It's also a homecoming, bringing us back to connection with our lived experience. This is our experience. Fear, but also the courage it takes to speak it aloud. Sorrow, and in equal measure love, for we only mourn that which we have loved. Anger, and the passion for justice from which it springs. Emptiness, and the blessing that is the space to create something new. And finally, hope. hope that encourages, hope that sustains, hope that can help us live into a new way. And indeed, there's ample cause for hope. We've heard earlier about the work of Rachel Carson. She's often recognized as the catalyst of the modern environmental movement, but she built on the work of people who had come before her. People who founded the Nature Conservancy and the Sierra Club, people who lobbied for legislation limiting water and air pollution, which was passed in the 40s and the 50s, and the people who came after Rachel Carson built on her work with research and education, more legislation, and the creation of the first Earth Day. We began in this nation with an environmental movement. Now, a little more than four decades later, we have many environmental movements, educating and acting, each with its own distinctive focus. The environmental justice movement has been primarily organized and led by people of color, indigenous people, and low-income people who are concerned about the health and safety of their particular communities. They've highlighted the ways in which economic oppression, racism, and environmental degradation intersect to create environmental destruction and health and safety risks in marginalized communities here in the United States and around the world. The ecumenical eco-justice movement has been primarily led by religious leaders who are concerned about efforts to protect the environment and that they not be placed in opposition to efforts to promote justice for people. The term eco-justice reflects the dual and interlocking commitments to ecology and justice. The modern eco-justice movement has now touched nearly all of the world's major religious traditions, and religion is playing an increasingly significant role in efforts to promote change for positive and healthy futures. The sustainable development and sustainable living movements have been led by leaders from a wide variety of fields, including academics, government officials, scientists, and others. This movement can be credited with the development of the Earth Charter, a document reflecting fundamental principles for a just, sustainable, and peaceful global society, which was drafted by an international committee and has subsequently been endorsed by nearly 5,000 entities, including governments and many international organizations. The environmental ethics movement has emerged among philosophers and ethicists and is primarily an academic field, which is concerned with defining principles to guide human behavior in the natural world. One of the foundational texts of this movement is A Sand County Almanac, written by Aldo Leopold. In one of the essays in that book, Leopold declares that a land ethic must take into account more than human life, but rather the whole biotic community, including soils, water, air, plants, animals, and people. He calls upon us to examine each choice in terms of what is ethically and aesthetically right, as well as what is economically expedient. A thing is right, he says, when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the whole biotic community. It's wrong when it tends otherwise. The environmental ethics movement has given birth to still more movements, including the deep ecology movement, which lifts up the inherent worth of all of Earth's ecological communities. This movement does not place human concerns as primary, but rather as a part of the totality of environmental concerns. Still other movements include animal welfare ethics, which advocates on behalf of all sentient organisms, and the ecofeminist movement, which is especially interested in the intersection of race, class, gender, and environmental ethics. I haven't exhausted the list of movements, but I have run out of time to list them. The point here is that there's ample cause for hope. There are many movements, each with its own distinctive focus, all working diligently and passionately on behalf of the planet. Joanna Macy cites all this energy organized in defense of the Earth as evidence of what's come to be called the Great Turning. The idea here is that we're finally beginning to understand that too many of our human ways are unsustainable, destructive, leading us to a dead end. Many of us are thus beginning to turn in a new direction. We're taking actions to defend the Earth and slow the damage. We're taking actions to learn what got us into this mess and to imagine new ways of organizing ourselves. We're beginning to live into new ways of understanding our place in the family of things. She cites as evidence the proliferation of movements in the last decades, including the ones that I've described. There's ample cause for hope. The Earth is in trouble, but its destiny is not yet finally written. Much depends on us. on our choices. Our choices will help determine the state of the planet that our children will inherit. The religious community is a good place to dig into the work. Unitarian Universalism is a very good place to dig into the work. Our theological and ethical tradition calls us to respect the interdependent web of existence of which we're all a part. The Unitarian Universalist Ministry for Earth is our national organization, which exists to equip us in our efforts. Recently, Ministry for Earth distributed a documentary called Renewal, which is highlighting stories of our nation's religious environmental efforts. The documentary tells stories of 8 varied and diverse religious communities. The Vanitas gave me a copy. They received it from Ministry from the Earth. And it will be playing downstairs during coffee hour. All of the clips are short. The longest is 15 minutes. And so I invite you to get a cup of coffee and sit, pull up a seat and watch some of the videos. They're all very inspiring. And I'd like to leave you with a description of just one. This is a movement led by Faith in Place, which is an organization in Chicago led by a Unitarian Universalist community minister named the Reverend Dr. Claire Butterfield. Faith in Place seeks to help religious communities find ways to live more deeply into their values by becoming good stewards of the earth. One of their efforts focuses on sustainable food. Over time, they had pulled many religious communities, especially Christian and Jewish communities, into their efforts to find ways to acquire sustainable food for their religious communities, but they had not found great success in reaching out to Muslim communities. So they started an organization called Taqwa, which partners with mosques to introduce the members of the mosques to the benefits of sustainable farming. One particular mosque is highlighted on this video. They dove into their study and learning and decided that they were going to purchase only local, organic, sustainably grown meat for Ramadan. And they did this through a relationship with a farmer in exurban Chicago, who agreed to slaughter and butcher the animals in accordance with Islamic law. By making this step, the members of the mosque realized that their prayers became truer prayers because the food which they were using to break the fast was a prayer itself. This is what I hope for us and for our children. I hope that we'll find ways to make our prayers truer prayers, to live into our prayers and the choices we make. Every little choice matters. Every little decision to live more gently upon the earth adds to the power of our collective prayer. Our prayer can be our hope. May it be bold enough to strengthen us and sustain us in this journey. Amen, and blessed be. An evolutionary prayer. We call upon the spirit of evolution, the miraculous force that inspires rocks and dust to weave themselves into biology. You have stood by us for millions and billions of years. Do not forsake us now. Empower us and awaken in us pure and dazzling creativity. You that can turn scales into feathers, sea water to blood, caterpillars to butterflies, metamorphose our species. Awaken in us powers that we need to survive the present crisis and evolve into more eons of our solar journey. Awaken in us a sense of who we truly are, tiny, ephemeral blossoms on the tree of life. Make the purposes and destiny of that tree our own purpose and destiny. Fill each of us with love for our own true self, which includes all of the creatures and plants and landscapes of the world. May we speak in all human councils on their behalf. May we awaken to our one and only true nature, none other than the nature of Gaia, this living planet Earth. We call upon the power which sustains the planets in their orbits, the wheels of our Milky Way in its 200 million year spiral, to imbue our personalities and relationships with harmony, endurance, and joy. Fill us with a sense of immense time so that our brief, flickering lives may truly reflect the work of vast ages past and also millions of years of evolution whose potential lies in our trembling hands. O stars, lend us your burning passion. O silence, give weight to our voice. I offer you this evolutionary prayer from John Seed, one of the visionary environmentalists of our own time. He's the founder and director of the Rainforest Information Center in Australia, and he helped initiate the U.S. Rainforest Action Network. He leads deep ecology workshops all around the world with the goal of helping people find the strength to change. Last year on Earth Day, we introduced the 40-40 for Earth Challenge. The idea was that each of us who was willing was asked to make one lifestyle change for the sake of the earth for 40 days. Many people from our congregation participated, and we heard from some who took part that those changes became permanent. Today, we're inviting you to commit yourselves once again. If you'd like to make a change for 40 days and you need some ideas, there's a handout on the table just outside the doors describing the 40-40 challenge and giving you some suggestions that you might take for the sake of the earth. But what I believe is that many of us know in the back of our minds something, one little thing that we've been meaning to do differently. And so if you've got one little thing in the back of your mind that you've been meaning to do differently for the sake of the planet, for the sake of us all, I invite you to call that to your mind and heart now. And then if you're ready to make a commitment to that one little thing, all together now at the same time, either aloud or silently, we'll call that one thing to our consciousness. One thing that we're going to do for the sake of all of us, for the sake of the planet. These are our promises. These are our prayers. For the sake of the earth and for the sake of us all, may we have the courage and the commitment to make them our new reality. I send you today with these words from the Torah. I call heaven and earth to witness today that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live. Go in peace.